Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. When we think of the founding fathers, one naturally gravitates towards Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, and Adams. That's John Adams, and just maybe his older cousin Samuel Adams. But of course, if you ask most people today about Samuel Adams, they know the name best as a refreshing beverage. But Adams was at the heart of the resistance to British taxation schemes that ended in open rebellion, from the Stamp Act until the Battle of Lexington and Concord, a period of 14 years. Samuel Adams was the single most important person leading Americans to what would eventually be independence. Despite this role in leading Bostonian resistance, whether as an eloquent writer or behind the scenes in groups ranging from the Sons of Liberty, the Circle of Nine, or the Massachusetts House of Commons, very little has been written about his life, in large part because Adams left few papers other than his newspaper articles written under dozens of pseudonyms. But Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Stacy Schiff is shedding new light on Adams' ability to control the pulse of Bostonians during this critical period in her book, The Revolutionary, Samuel Adams. It's published by Little Brown. Schiff is the author of a number of critically acclaimed biographies on books ranging from Cleopatra to the Salem witch trials to Benjamin Franklin and France. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Stacy Schiff, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, I'm delighted to join you, Rich.
My first encounter with Samuel Adams, like most people in my generation, was Esther Forbes' Johnny Tremaine, in which he wasn't really the protagonist, but he was certainly featured as this man who was central of the rebellion that would grow into the revolution. But it's interesting, as you read histories of the American Revolution, Samuel Adams is, while depicted as central to the start of the conflict, he's also depicted as sort of a rhetorical bomb thrower, a Machiavelli of chaos, as you write in the book, and nothing more. You paint a far more nuanced picture of Samuel Adams. Is that what attracted you to writing about him?
You put your finger on it to a great extent. Most chroniclers of those years will point up his supremacy, but they won't really explain it. They'll say he's, you know, central to the story. Esther Forbes makes him the most radical mind in Boston, but no one really defines his role. And that led me to go back to look at what his contemporaries said about him. And if you read his contemporaries, you get a very clear picture of him being more than just at the center of things, being, you know, very much a mastermind in many ways behind some of the seminal events in American history. And you get a very different picture of him as well. You don't quite get the ragtag ruffian that I think many of us have reduced him to. If you read John Adams in particular, you get a sense of an extremely affable, decorous, gentle, sweet, patient man who's in fact very prudent, strategic, but also very prudent in his thinking. And so, yes, that was partly what sent me back. Partly what sent me back to him was the fact that it was 2016, and I think we were all thinking a lot about where democracy came from. And I was just sort of, I had gone back to my work with Benjamin Franklin and realized that Samuel Adams makes a cameo in that book, and I had never really thought about him myself either.
When you read this book in the post-Trump era, it also gives you a bit of pause, because not only was Adams an incredibly electrifying speaker, he was able to rouse crowds with his oratory. He had his finger on so many pulses within the city, and actually, as the rebellion approached, the whole area, the region. He had learned through the 15 or 16 years he had been sort of canvassing a lot of these areas. But it gives you pause when you read how much mob action was at the heart of the way of expressing grievance.
If you put him back into the revolution, you get a very different revolution. Exactly. I think that we have for a long time, and with some minor exceptions, preferred a more intellectual, a more high-minded, a sanitized American Revolution. And when you begin to look back at the events that precede 1776, you see a lot of street theater, and you see boycotts, and you see pickets, and you see extra-legal institutions, and you see violence, which was pretty much scrubbed out of the story afterwards. I think that, you know, the sort of Jefferson and his pen and the beautiful wardrobe at the Continental Congress are the things that are closer to our minds than are, for example, the street scenes after the Stamp Act, the Stamp Act protests and the destruction that accompany it. John Adams talks about that as the revolution that precedes the real American Revolution. He talks about that as the revolution in thinking. And for that, everyone points a finger to Samuel Adams as the man most responsible, because he is writing for those years. He's not encouraging violence, but he is writing for those years incessantly, dauntlessly, and under something like 30 pseudonyms.
Yeah. Now, earlier you said you learned about Adams through his contemporaries, and there's a good reason why. How difficult was it to tell the story of a man who left few, if any, papers? And at least during the period of this heyday, most of his correspondents perhaps said, burn after reading.
Not only did it say that, but from John Adams, we have a scene of Samuel Adams sitting in Philadelphia at the Continental Congress and, in fact, feeding his papers to the fire. And when John says to Cousin Samuel, Samuel is the older of the two, you know, aren't you maybe overreacting a little bit by burning all of that? Samuel replies that he doesn't want their Confederates to suffer for his negligence. I mean, he's clearly very much, you know, covering up the fingerprints here. And it's because he's having to cover up the trail, and because he is so much a team player, that he is harder to document. I mean, he's very much given to playing behind the scenes, to working on committees, to seeing that responsibility is diffuse. And he's very accustomed to reading about the fact that he's about to be arrested and hanged in Great Britain for treason. So he's, you know, he's playing with fire here. And that does make finding the trail, deciphering the symbols, much more complicated, I will admit. And when I say 30 pseudonyms, by the way, there are probably many more that we just haven't detected. There's a great deal of papers that remains all the same, despite his attempts to destroy things. There are also a lot of letters about him. And in particular, there is a wealth of material in the British archives because, of course, all of the crown officials, and in particular, the royal governors and the lieutenant governors, are writing back to Great Britain over and over again about this nuisance, Samuel Adams, this Machiavelli of chaos, because Adams has on his side one tremendous weapon, which is the fact that these men tend to underestimate him. And they think that if this Adams fellow could be arrested, then the resistance movement could be nipped in the bud.
It's easy in hindsight to understand why he burned his paper, because of all the revolutionary leaders, he is perhaps the only one that had to spend the night in a swamp as British soldiers are looking for him on the night of Lexington and Concord. He's hiding in a swamp to prevent his arrest.
And that's why the book opens where it does, because literally I was sitting in an archive one day and it suddenly hit me that we all know that Paul Revere jumps on his horse that April and rides madly west. But I don't think most of us anyway stop for a second to think, where was he going? And where he's going at top speed is indeed to warn John Hancock and Samuel Adams that the soldiers are marching out to arrest them, which is the understanding at that point in Boston that the mission of those redcoats is to arrest Samuel Adams, John Hancock, and to deport them to Great Britain for trial.
Now, you really pick up the story, as you mentioned, you start the book with that incident in April of 1775, but you really pick up the story midway through his life. You tell a little bit about his early life, but his early life was pretty uneventful until he began. In fact, he had some moderate wealth. His father was something to do with brewing. I think he was a malter, and they had a wharf, and so they had a good income. And by the time we meet him in your book, he's managed to squander most of this. He was not a good businessman. He was not a rich member of New England society, unlike most of the other of our founding fathers that were quite well off.
That indeed sets him apart. And it's actually a sort of interesting twist, also something that's misunderstood about him on the part of his enemies, who write him off as a disappointed sort of desperado, a man who can't find his place, but who failed to recognize the fact that Adams is indeed downwardly mobile, but because he begins with wealth, he has chosen this route. He has chosen to remain penniless. He has chosen to give his life to political ideals. And he's not invested in any kind of ambition. In fact, if there are two things he writes most vociferously about before the revolution, it's basically ambition and avarice. He's a very pure soul in many ways. So he comes from great wealth, indeed squanders a fortune, indeed proves that he's spectacularly ill-suited to business, and then pretty much starts writing for a short-lived newspaper. And it's in the course of writing for that paper, when he begins very much to sound like the Samuel Adams we'll hear later, that he distinguishes himself for the quality of his prose. And he then begins to collaborate on and polish the writings of friends who are members of the Massachusetts House of Representatives. So that's kind of the ramp toward his political career. But it's throughout his life, he has no profession. In fact, it's very hard, even when his enemies want to dismiss him, it's very hard for them to attach a profession to him because he doesn't really have one. And he lives to a great extent on charity, on handouts. Mm. I think John Hancock was probably his great benefactor.
And there were numbers of his benefactors that eventually he found out he was opposing later through the ramp up to revolution. I found it really interesting. One of the things you write about Adams was he was a man who could produce a mob and utter calm. And he did both during his time in the sort of build up to what would eventually become the beginning of the revolution, in this very tense Boston situation where Boston was constantly at conflict with royal authorities, whether it be the governor or with the crown itself. Not necessarily the crown, but the actions of the crown.
You see little glimpses of him early on. There's a marvelous letter from the Sons of Liberty, who are the sort of local band of resistors to John Adams, who at this point is just a very young, inexperienced, but brilliant lawyer. And the Sons of Liberty want John Adams to do something for them. And to their letter, they affix a postscript, which essentially says, you know, your cousin Samuel thanks you for helping us. So there's a sort of endorsement of their work, which obviously is worth its weight in gold. And then you see Adams behind the scenes in making the Boston Massacre into a quote unquote massacre, which it, in fact, for all of its ill effects, is not, for basically using the Boston Massacre for its propaganda value as well. And then you see him very much behind the scenes at the Boston Tea Party, where, you know, we have very little of him on the subject. But if you read the few accounts of those people deposed in London afterwards who actually felt free to speak about what had happened that night, you see Adams as the prime mover throughout those very tense days when Boston was deciding what to do with the tea, which they refused to land. Their feeling is basically 10 years of principle rests on not accepting this tea. How are they going to somehow turn it back to London? And if they can't, what is to become of it? And in the depositions about what happens that night, you see Adams very much as the prime mover in those discussions.
My guest today is Stacy Schiff. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer, a historian, and her latest book is titled The Revolutionary, Samuel Adams. It's published by Little Brown, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the things he was for a period of time, he was sort of a minor town official in a way. I think he collected taxes. And one of the things this was very helpful to him in beginning resistance, he moved through all classes of life, upper class, the nouveau rich, if you will, you know, like John Hancock, for example, to various tradesmen. He was known and moved in all of these different circles and seemed to do that effortlessly.
I think it's something that really sets him apart and that we can't underestimate. I mean, in terms of its importance, I think that's actually very consequential. I mean, this is a man who, unlike most others, Boston's a very hierarchical town, so hierarchical that when you went to Harvard, you were ranked in the Harvard class by your father's status in town. And that status, your Harvard rank, determined where you sat in chapel and when you got served and where you lived. It determined everything about your collegiate experience. And Adams, in fact, ranks at the top of his class, as John Adams will not over a decade later. So he's from this very well-educated and very wealthy milieu. But as you say, he spends those years in the streets getting to know bricklayers and bakers. He's equally at home among the innkeepers of Boston as he is among the political elite. And he feels from an early age, and this is clear in his master's thesis at Harvard, in his early writings in the 1740s, as it is in the 1760s when resistance to Great Britain begins, he's very clear on the idea that the common man deserves to be heard and deserves a voice in determining his own destiny. Very many years later, a great friend of Adams's would distill his philosophy, Adams's philosophy, to two principles. He would say that Adams believed that the government should have little and the people much, and that basically privilege and wealth should step aside to make room for genius and industry. So he's always on the side of the common man, always believes that governmental prerogative is important, but it should stand in proper proportion to the people's will.
A good part of the book talks about the Stamp Act. The Stamp Act comes in the wake of the French and Indian War. The Crown feels as if they've incurred an enormous expense protecting the colonies, and they need to receive money in their coffers to allay that outlay. And your description of the Stamp Act gives me really new insight into the sort of roots of the Revolution, if you will. We always think of the Stamp Act leading to the Townshend Acts, leading to the Tea Act, and then finally a complete rupture with troops in Boston. And really, the Stamp Act was seemingly, in your account, far more influential and important in understanding the roots of what would lead to the Revolution.
I'm not sure there was an issue. I think John Adams specifically says this. There was no issue before the Stamp Act that so perfectly united the colonies. And I think it would be a long time afterward until there was such an issue. I mean, it is really a colossal misstep on the part of the Crown, in the sense that every demographic in the colonies has reason to object to this act. Essentially, all Great Britain is trying to do at that point, other than raise some revenue, obviously, for some very expensive colonies, is to define in some rational way, better define the relationship between mother country and colonies. And that's particularly difficult to do with the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which has had a more independent government than have had many of the colonies over the previous years. And nowhere in the Massachusetts Charter does the word parliament appear. So this very idea that parliament should feel entitled to legislate for the colonies is anathema to someone like Samuel or John Adams at this point. And it really, I mean, it sets off a wildfire throughout the colonies, but particularly in Boston, which is a very volatile town, and at this point, an economically disadvantaged town in many ways. The Stamp Act sets off real fires and real street protests. To some extent, that legislation is also based on the idea, on the rumors that Great Britain is hearing of tremendous colonial prosperity. And as even royal governors will say, the passing of the act is like killing the golden goose. You know, this is a way actually to sort of detach the colonies from the mother country, not by any means to rope them into a closer relationship.
Hmm. And his role during the Stamp Act in sort of being absolutely seeming loyal, but also decrying the effect of the Stamp Act, seems to be key. And again, he uses mobs effectively. He takes the lieutenant governor, basically loots his house. I mean, a lot of extra legal means in protesting, and yet at the other time, being absolutely within the law and making cogent arguments under the colony charter and everything else that this is not legal and should not be stood for.
I don't think I would place him, Adams, behind the riots that destroy, among others, Thomas Hutchinson's house, although let us be clear, Samuel Adams deplored Thomas Hutchinson, so I don't think he had much sympathy for the then lieutenant governor, who was Hutchinson. But the first colonial salvo against imperial authority, the first objection to the Stamp Act as it went to London, was indeed written by Samuel Adams. And it is certainly the Stamp Act that puts him on the stage, in the sense that it's the cooperation around those events and his ability to articulate the resistance to the act that gets him elected to the Massachusetts House and is therefore the beginning of his political career. And essentially what he says is that he makes the obvious argument. The colonies are not represented in Parliament. They have as much right, as he puts it, to the colonies have as much right to participate in their own governance, in this case, as they have to appoint the Emperor of China. Why does Parliament think it has any role here? And then he goes on splendidly in a later vein to basically say the two governments, the government in Great Britain and the government in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, are analogous. They're completely the same. So why shouldn't the colonies, in fact, tax the mother country? So he just takes the thing to its logical extreme and explodes it.
Now, a lot of this portion of the book, you're reading the accounts of his political adversaries, Thomas Hutchinson, who was at that point the lieutenant governor, later would become the governor at the point of the Boston Tea Party, and Francis Bernard, who was the governor at that particular point. What do you learn about Adams through their accounts of Adams himself?
Well, we have to be grateful to those men, the poor beleaguered crown officials. First of all, Adams is running circles around them, and they're doing their best to just try to maintain order despite his attempts to make them just fall through loophole after loophole. But they are the ones who tell us really what's going on in Boston in those years. And here's where the fingerprintlessness comes in. Adams, of course, never says, I did this and then I did that. But Thomas Hutchinson or Francis Bernard might write back to London and say, for example, shortly after Adams's election to the House of Representatives, he and his friends take it upon themselves to have built a gallery in the House so that the people of Boston can actually watch their government in action. It's like installing cameras in Congress, essentially. And to this, there's a great objection on the part of Francis Bernard, then the governor, who thinks that this is turning government basically into a kind of theater. But from Adams's point of view, what it is making government accountable to the people. And of course, he never writes about this, but we have Hutchinson and Bernard's accounts of that. So they're able to write down, they're able to give us the picture of much of what Adams is doing. Occasionally they credit him with misdeeds that are in fact those of others. So occasionally he gets too much credit for what he's done. They're very quick to point out pieces in the press, for example, that are clearly Adams's. So we also have them to thank for identifying some of Adams's writing in the press. But it's hard not to feel sorry for them. I mean, especially in the case of Thomas Hutchinson, this is an enormously diligent, dutiful, devoted public servant. He has exactly the background Adams has, but he feels that duty impels him, obviously, to be loyal to the crown. He too objects to the Stamp Act, in fact, but he's essentially handcuffed by the fact that he is lieutenant governor and therefore cannot object to some of these pieces of legislation. And Adams, both Adamses, in fact, come to the table with this inexplicable hatred of Thomas Hutchinson, whom they make in many ways the face of tyranny, so that the face of British overreach at home can become in Boston the face of Thomas Hutchinson. And it's a very effective propaganda tool to turn him into the villain of the piece.
Well, one of the things that's very interesting about Adams' rhetoric, it could be fiery, it could rouse people to take action, it could also be very soothing, and it could be very rational. And he must have been just an amazing speaker and writer, as far as he's able to adopt all sorts of tones depending on the situation.
I don't know that he would have been a particularly eloquent speaker. He seems to be more comfortable on the page from the accounts we have. Thomas Jefferson will say of him, for example, later in Congress, that because he spoke so seldom, people listened to him very intently when he did speak, because he was very crystalline in his arguments. He was able always to clarify things very easily. But yes, on the page, he's utterly protean. He's often writing under multiple pseudonyms in different papers at the same time. And each of those characters, so to speak, will have a slightly different voice. Some of those, each of the pseudonyms is used to address a different issue. For example, after the Boston Massacre, when he's essentially objecting to the idea that soldiers who have fired on civilians have been exonerated of blame, he's writing as Vindex. And in another situation, he might be writing as a Chatterer, or he might be writing as Alfred, or he might be writing as Candidus. I mean, he has this stable of pseudonyms, most of them adapted to a single purpose.
What's really interesting, though, is, you know, Samuel Adams plays this incredible central role in the lead up to revolution, to the beginning of revolution, and then very quickly goes to the back pages of history. Why was that?
It's a very hard thing to explain, and I'm not sure I can entirely do so. He's clearly much more interested in ideas than in institutions. So he is not particularly, he's much more interested in insisting on and identifying grievances, on correcting grievances. He's not all that interested in building a government. One of his enemies will, in fact, say of him that as soon as the war is over, Adams will sink into insignificance because he'll have nothing to object to. And that, in a funny way, is actually true. He also is very much a committed, almost parochial New Englander. He's not completely certain about, he's not a Federalist by any means. He's not completely certain about this Confederation. He has a certain chauvinism about New England, and that keeps him both from playing a national role and from, I think, rising to the heights, in fact, over these years when you're looking for national figures. So yes, I think part of it is the parochialism. Part of it is he's very good at loophole locating and grievance sharpening. And I think part of it is that he's older at this point. I mean, it's important to remember that he's really a generation older than most of the other founders. So he's begun to seem a little bit worn by the end of the revolution. Mm.
What also comes out is once the revolution is over, he still remains this sort of dedicated idealist towards republicanism, and less government is better.
Very much. To your point, there's a really beautiful, very eloquent letter of Thomas Jefferson's to Adams at Jefferson's inauguration. After the inauguration, he writes to Adams and says of his inaugural address, "I hope you heard that for what it was, which was essentially a private letter to you, because I was trying to channel your ideals. I was trying to channel your spirit." And he refers to Adams as the apostle of liberty. And he basically says, you know, this was essentially, the inaugural address was essentially my attempt to prove that your ideas have been tested in the crucible of time and have come out pure. And it really speaks to Adams's role there in terms of defining the issues at hand rather than establishing the government.
Hmm. It's a fascinating account. The name of the book is The Revolutionary. Stacy Schiff, it's always a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rich.
Pulitzer Prize winning biographer Stacy Schiff speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her latest book is titled The Revolutionary, Samuel Adams. It's published by Little Brown. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.